You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Welcome, everyone. My name's Amar Bhattacharya. I'm Senior Fellow in Global Economy and Development. Privilege for me to open the session. Glad that so many of you were able to make it on a rainy Friday morning, but that's better than a rainy Friday afternoon. So I wanted to begin by setting a little bit the context and then turn the proceedings over to my colleague Josh Meltzer, who's the main star of the show. I think it's fair to say that Paris was a landmark agreement, at a time when such a landmark agreement was needed in terms of tackling the perhaps the most important challenge of our time, which is climate change. And I think it is, it was indeed a time when all countries of the world, where the private sector, where civil society came together with a sense of purpose, ambition. That really is one of those moments that I think we can feel proud about in a world that is quite fragmented and divisive at this in this day. But having said that, I think it's also clear that the ambitions of Paris are, in some sense, not going to be met if we stay with the present trajectories that we are on. If you look at the goals of the 1.5 degrees and you look at the aggregate commitments that have been made to date, we are more in the kind of 2 to 3 degree world rather than the 1.5 to 2 degree world. So there's still a lot to be done in terms of ramping up ambition. And it's also fair to say that since Paris, the impact of climate change has become even more evident. We now know that the top 20 hottest years that the planet has seen has been since 1995, and the top five has been since the 2000s. So there's clear evidence of climate change happening, and with it, severity of climate and extremities of climate, including floods and droughts and the like. Now, at the heart of this challenge actually is what my colleague will talk about, which is sustainable infrastructure. Why? Because so much of emissions comes from sustainable infrastructure, and because sustainable infrastructure sets a trajectory that lasts not just for decades, but for the future, because it's the way in which we set the future patterns of growth. But it's not only about climate, it's of course the foundation of growth itself, and it's the foundation for sustainable development, including the attainment of the sustainable development goals. So in a sense, therefore, sustainable infrastructure, which is really the story of the new growth paradigm. It's actually not about the costs of investing in climate, but the opportunities that now come from a very different kind of growth than we have had in the past. But in order to do that, we need to do two things. We need to scale up the investments in infrastructure, and we need for that infrastructure to be very different than it has been in the past. And the term that we use is low carbon infrastructure, as a way to signify that this is actually a very different kind of infrastructure, and the financing challenge for that is huge. We know that some 90 trillion or so will have to be invested in infrastructure in the next 15 years or so, and we know that a very large proportion of that has to be low carbon infrastructure. But how do we go about doing that? What is going to be the role of the private sector, and what's going to be the role of multilateral development finance and the role of concessional finance? That's the discussion that you are here for. And to kick it off, I'm going to ask my colleague Josh Meltzer, who I've had the privilege to work with now closely on these topics for three or so years. He has prepared a paper, and on the basis of that paper, he will share the findings. And I think it's particularly important that we recognize that we have had an architecture that has flaws, but has had also a lot of success. In particular, I want to sort of commend the role of the climate investment funds had played. But unfortunately, and this is my personal view, just at the point as it was beginning to fly, the international community decided in its wisdom to clip its wings. So I would like to, you know, also highlight that we still have a lot of work to be done in terms of a robust architecture, and that's a discussion I hope we will have when we have the panel. I will introduce the panel after Josh has made his presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Amar. Thanks for the introduction, and it's great to be here, and thank you for everyone for making it out here today. The world's core infrastructure, as Amar mentioned, which we can think of as including our transport and energy systems, buildings, industries, and land-related activities, produce approximately 60% of global greenhouse gas emissions. Yet, as we've heard, we've also got very significant infrastructure needs over the next 15 years or so, approximately $90 trillion in infrastructure needs to be built. And meeting this infrastructure goal itself would require doubling the global capital stock. Now, unless the infrastructure that we build is what we call low-carbon climate resilient, I'll refer to it as LCR infrastructure, the world is going to lock itself into a high carbon pathway and miss the Paris Agreement's goal of well below 2 degrees Celsius. So we think of LCR infrastructure primarily as being investments in things like renewable energy, low carbon transport systems, and energy efficiency measures. This diagram here shows the LCR infrastructure needs and business as usual. So what we can see that under business as usual, approximately between $53 and $70 trillion of infrastructure that is going to be built could be low carbon. And we get this range because some of this infrastructure is very conditional in nature. For instance, building gas-fired electricity could be consistent with a 2-degree goal if gas is a bridging fuel to a zero-carbon electricity source. Similarly, when you think about transmission and distribution, it all depends on the type of the electricity source running over that infrastructure. Yet to build the necessary amounts of LCR infrastructure that would be consistent with 2 degrees requires approximately an additional $13.5 trillion investment, primarily in renewable energy and energy efficiency, which points to a sort of annual financing gap of approximately $1 trillion per annum. The diagram up here also shows that under a 2-degree scenario, there's going to be significant reallocations of investment. So we're going to get less investment in fossil fuels. We're going to also require less investment due to more compact cities. And this leads to approximately net increases in investment of around $4 trillion over that 15-year period. And this doesn't take into account additional possible savings from lower operating costs from low carbon infrastructure, which have been estimated at around $5 trillion. And it really underscores, I think, the point that Amar made in the introduction, that there is no inherent trade-off necessarily between building low carbon infrastructure and growth and development. As noted, whether we build low-carbon infrastructure is also going to be key in terms of meeting the Sustainable Development Goals. So around 60% of the LCR infrastructure needs are going to be in developing countries. And the link between building LCR infrastructure and the climate and development agendas are linked in multiple ways. So, for instance, you think about the impact of climate change, which is being most acutely felt in the developing world and the most vulnerable people. And this link, in fact, between development and climate is reflected in the SDGs themselves. Building LCR infrastructure also has a direct effect on development outcomes. So, for instance, building low-carbon renewable energy instead of coal-fired power plants, for instance, can reduce air pollution and produce better health outcomes. Building more compact cities with access to mass transit affects access to other key infrastructure services such as education and health. But a key challenge here is financing the needed low-carbon infrastructure. We know that public finances are constrained, and so private capital is going to be key to meeting these investment needs. And the estimates are that anywhere between a third and a half of the incremental investment needs are going to have to come from the private sector. Increased private sector investment in LCR infrastructure can also produce significant efficiency gains. Fortunately, as this diagram underscores, that there is no shortage of private capital globally. In particular, we can see here that institutional investors have assets under management of approximately $85 trillion, which is expected to grow to $110 trillion by 2020. Yet currently, allocations from institutional investors into infrastructure are low, estimated at around 1% of total asset allocations. There's also a shortage of other private capital for infrastructure, and particularly for LCR infrastructure in developing countries. Now, this lack of investment in infrastructure by institutional investors, as well as the private sector more broadly, is due to a range of infrastructure risks and other barriers. LCR infrastructure as well carries particular risks. So, for instance, limited investment track records for new climate technologies raises investment risk. Reliance on government support for LCR infrastructure, such as feed-in tariffs or subsidies, creates forms of sort of political and policy risk. LCR infrastructure risks are also even higher in developing countries when you think about political instability, poor investment climates, and currency risk. A lack of a carbon price and fossil fuel subsidies also mean that the full social cost of investing in high carbon infrastructure is not properly reflected in investment decisions. We also know that LCR infrastructure risks vary over the project lifestyle. So, for instance, risks are particularly high at the project preparation stage due to challenges related to developing often complex infrastructure plans and obtaining things like permits. Then as project construction commences, risks grow even further due to macroeconomic risks, business uncertainties, potential construction delays, permit cancellations, and shifts in the availability of finance. And it's really not until the project is up and running and actually generating a cash flow that risks decline and there is a potential for a return on investment. In addition, we have knowledge and viability gaps, such as when projects fail to generate revenue streams to meet debt servicing obligations or lack of local capacity to structure public-private projects. This diagram just underscores this notion that as a consequence of these LCR infrastructure risks, the cost of capital climbs and finance becomes scarce. So even where an LCR infrastructure project should proceed, because the social rate of return when we take into account the development and climate benefits are particularly high, the internal rate of return that the investors receive is below the cost of capital and the project doesn't get funded. So this in turn stymies LCR infrastructure projects and it also diverts investment into what is often lower cost but higher carbon alternatives. So addressing these LCR infrastructure investment challenges requires aligning public and private finance in a manner that allows for the full range of risks to be borne. Now, combining sources of public finance, such as from the multilateral development banks and the multilateral climate funds, is a form of blended finance that can reduce risk, lower the cost of capital, and crowd in private sector finance into LCR infrastructure. Now, the MDBs in particular have the knowledge and financial position to play a central role here, blending their own capital with climate finance to reduce risk and crowd in private sector capital. And the MDBs we know are increasing their investments, their climate investments, yet they also face constraints in terms of the amount of finance that they can provide and the risks that they can accept. There are also a range of multilateral climate funds. In the paper that you've picked up when you came in here, we focus on the climate investment funds, the Global Environment Facility, and the Green Climate Fund, which cover approximately 90% of all multilateral climate finance. And these multilateral climate funds are themselves blended finance facilities which are designed to co-finance with other public and private sources of capital. And these funds can have the greatest impact by addressing the financing barriers to LCEI infrastructure by providing small amounts of highly concessional finance alongside other public finance to reduce risk and crowd in private sector capital into transformative, low-carbon, climate-resilient projects. Now, the MDBs also provide concessional finance. About a third of MDB finance, of their loans, are concessional finance. But often the multilateral climate funds are actually providing even higher concessional finance, particularly when it comes to lending to middle-income countries where the climate needs and the LCR infrastructure needs are most acute. And while some World Bank finance is, for instance, on loans similar to the highly concessional, if we take the Clean Technology Fund finance, it is often directed and limited to low-income countries. This stylized figure here shows basically this risks and cash flows over a project lifecycle and some of the scope for multilateral development bank, multilateral climate funds and private finance to come in and blend. So first we need to underscore that we need to use MDB and the climate funds to improve countries' enabling environment. This can reduce risk across the entire infrastructure project lifecycle and includes, for instance, strengthening investment environments and institutional capacity. And often a lot of this is already being undertaken by the MDBs as part of their broader development mandate. The MDBs are also supporting sort of more targeted efforts to build infrastructure-specific enabling environments, such as their engagement and support for the global infrastructure facility. But often here, this work is focused on infrastructure and not necessarily low-carbon, climate-resilient infrastructure. And this is where the multilateral climate funds can be used to link MDB support for enabling environment work with efforts to boost country-level capacity to assess low-carbon, climate-resilient alternatives and to help build a pipeline of LCR infrastructure projects. At the project preparation stage, financing is often very scarce in the private sector, risks are high, and there's often relying on short-term bank loans or sponsor equity. And this is where there's a key role for both the MDBs and the multilateral climate funds, either through grants and other forms of assistance, to help overcome that, particularly in developing countries. Also, there's clearly a role here for developing the capacity to consider, for instance, use of best available climate technologies at the project preparation stage or building in consideration of the Paris Agreement below 2-degree goal into the broader set of aims for that infrastructure project. And once we move into the project construction phase, obviously more and more finance is needed. And at this point, the high cost of capital can really make projects infeasible and where the blending of both MDB and multilateral climate finance is key to reducing risk and bringing in private sector capital. At the same time, we also see that the approaches to financing infrastructure are evolving rapidly. As the multilateral development banks in particular ramp up their climate financing and are guided by the cascade approach to finance, which emphasises risk mitigation before direct loans, the multilateral climate funds should be prepared and able to address the remaining financing gaps. Now, using scarce public finance to crowd in private sector capital into low-carbon, climate-resilient infrastructure leads to a focus on rates of private sector co-financing as one measure of success. So, for instance, the Clean Technology Fund has co-funding ratios of about 1 to 9.5. The Global Environment Facility reports 1 to 13. And the co-financing occurs both at the project level and at the fund or facility level. So, for instance, the multilateral climate funds invest directly into low-carbon climate-resilient projects, but they also invest into what I refer to as domestic financial entities, which then on-lend to further LCR infrastructure projects. So here, a complementary measure of success picked up in this diagram is this notion of leverage, which captures a larger financing envelope that includes additional resources committed either as a result of the infrastructure project or due to other policy reforms. So, for instance, this could include the building of a renewable energy project as a result of public investment into transmission and distribution. The diagram here also, I think, underscores really the importance of strengthening the enabling environment for LCR infrastructure, the capacity to reduce risk across the infrastructure lifestyle, which should create opportunities for private sector capital to come in and to free up the multilateral climate finance to then invest in even more high-risk and transformative LCR infrastructure projects. In the paper you've got, we then do quite an analysis of the importance, particularly of the Clean Technology Fund, which is the largest provider to date of blended finance. And it provides, I think, some important insights on the success and outcomes of the roles of blending in crowding in private sector capital for LCR infrastructure. And the data in the paper encompasses 126 projects with CTF finance, a clean technology fund finance, one of the funds under the climate investment funds of about $5.25 billion. And the following conclusions range and they link allocations of finance and risk levels. It's worth pointing out that some of this is tentative, particularly allocation of risk levels is often project-specific and country-specific, which limits the ability to compare this across country levels. But some of the key findings from the data, for instance, are that the majority of clean technology finance has been in the form of highly concessional or so-called soft loans, which also went towards investments with the highest risk, which we would expect to see. The Clean Technology Fund's share of total finance was highest for projects with the highest risk. And at the same time, we also see, though, that the CTF was most successful at mobilising private capital into highest risk projects. Now, the paper also distinguishes in there between direct investments, which I mentioned before, and investments into domestic financial entities, which are then on lend. Bring up all the different slides. You can sort of just go through them in the paper. But essentially, you know, as I said, investments in these domestic financial entities capture some of the impact of investing in capacity building to improve enabling environments. And it also picks up one of the dimensions of this notion of leverage about how an initial investment and the on-lending can then provide additional opportunities for investing in LCR infrastructure. Now, investments in domestic financial entities tend to be a lot smaller than direct investments into projects, so it tends to be in things like improving energy efficiency or distributed solar projects, which is in contrast to the direct investments which are in larger projects such as into concentrated solar or wind energy. So, for instance, in terms of a domestic financial entity investment, there was one in Turkey where the Clean Technology Fund supported the development by financial intermediaries to lend for energy efficiency purposes. Now, direct CTF investments into LCR projects have mobilised more private sector capital than they have through domestic financial entities. Yet, as noted, through the domestic financial entities and through their on-lending, they can then leverage additional sources of public and private capital. So to take one example, which involved the IFC and the JEF in the China Energy Efficiency Program, which then involved basically a grant to banks that lent to market participants such as utilities and businesses to implement energy efficiency measures. Now, the IFC estimates that that grant mobilised about 1.5 times private sector capital into the initial investment, but if you take into account the on-lending that then happened, that becomes three times the private sector investment. So the paper, I think, shows that, you know, the multilateral climate funds, and specifically with the focus on the Clean Technology Fund, have produced real success in blending with MDB finance to mobilise private sector capital for low carbon infrastructure. It's also been very good at mainstreaming more broadly climate into the MDB work. Though one of the findings in this paper is that there may be a need also to improve the ability of multilateral climate funds to take on more risk when it comes to investing in LCR projects. Now, certainly, I think the CTF has a good track record in pushing the risk envelope. If you look at, for instance, building out the concentrated solar market in Morocco, for instance. But the high levels of private sector mobilisation at the higher risk level suggest that there may be scope to move that further. And this ultimately may also, I think, require donors to be prepared themselves to accept more risk. Another point worth making is that co-financing as a metric of success is important, and often investing small amounts of public finance and mobilising high levels of private sector capital is seen as a good risk management strategy. Yet at the same time, I think we also need to avoid over-reliance on co-financing levels for a couple of key points. One is that high private co-financing into a project can also signal a lack of risk-taking by multilateral lenders and could even signal some crowding out of the private sector. There's also not necessarily an inherent link between high private co-financing and climate outcomes. So this suggests that there may be projects with high risks where private sector appetite will be limited, but the climate outcomes may be very significant. And finally, the capacity for both the MDBs and the multilateral climate funds to mobilise private capital is going to depend crucially on the availability of a bankable projects. And yet we know that lack of bankable projects remains a key barrier to increasing investments in LCR infrastructure. So this also suggests that there's a role for looking more closely at leverage ratios, also alongside co-financing, to assess how the MDBs and the multilateral climate funds have been successful at mobilising private sector capital. Certainly such ratios are harder to measure than co-financing, but they're likely to be one of the key channels by which we move from billions to trillions and we scale up the financing needed for low carbon climate resilient infrastructure. Thanks, I think I'll leave it at that.
Many thanks, Josh. If I could ask the panel to come up. Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Good. Okay, so on the basis of that really great presentation, Josh, I think I want to have a conversation now around a number of themes. I want to begin with where I actually started, which is the scale and urgency of the challenge. You know, in the next 20 years, the world economy will double. In the next 40 years, the world's urban population will double. And as a consequence of those trends, in the next 15 years, as Josh pointed out, the stock of infrastructure will double. And at the same time, during that period, in the next 15 years, we know that carbon emissions must come down by some 25%. So that's the context. And the frame of action, of course, is Paris. And as we started by saying, Paris is great in ambition. It has set processes in place. And one person who has been very closely associated with the follow-up processes is John Room. And I'd like to ask you, John, to begin the conversation, and then I'll turn to the other panelists. But before I do that, actually, I was remiss. I should introduce my panelists. So let me begin, starting with the right. We have actually a great lineup. Mathieu Pagan from the Inter-American Development. I have to get the corporation now, right? the private sector arm of the Inter-American Development Bank, working on blended finance. He's our first panelist. Sitting next to him on his left is John Room. He's the Senior Director for Climate Change at the World Bank. And as I mentioned, he has really been at the epicenter for much of the discussions on the follow-up to Paris. Last but not least, Cruzquer Sierra Escalante, from Manager of Blended Finance Unit in IFC. And she also heads the MDV group on blended finance, so she has a great purview of the broader discussions on blended finance, and of course, Josh Meltzer. So let me turn to you, John. If you could maybe set the context, and what do you think was needed now to really raise ambitions? And what, where, you know, we had this meeting of in Brussels yesterday, and recognition that, you know, 2020 is going to be a key year. But can you help set the context for this discussion?
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So just a quick comment on the scale and the urgency to supplement what Amar said. It's not only we're going to double the amount of infrastructure that we've had, it's got to be low carbon resilient. If we get it wrong and we can't address climate change, we're going to have 100 million more people in poverty by 2030. We're going to have up to 143 million more climate migrants in three regions. And we're going to have, we're already seeing losses due to adverse weather-related hazardous events of over $500 billion a year. That's if you get it wrong. The flip side, IFC has calculated that the value of business opportunities in the in the largest NDCs is $23 trillion. We also know that if we take action that will address climate change, we can reduce congestion in cities, we can increase economic productivity, we can reduce air pollution. So you've got a balance here. In terms of the urgency, just to put the numbers in a very colloquial way, we've got to peak emissions by 2020. We've got to halve those emissions 10 years after that. We've got to halve emissions 10 years after that. And we've pretty much got to be carbon neutral by 2050. That is a huge challenge that we have available. Now, lots of good things are going on. We've got technology on our side. Prices are falling. And as you look around the world, you can see a number of individual financial institutions saying, we want to put more money in. You have a few countries doing carbon budgeting and putting the right policies in place. We're seeing carbon pricing etching up here and there, and we've got some very good projects. And we from the World Bank, we committed to deliver, World Bank Group, 28% of our climate finance by 2020 to climate. 28% of our overall financing to climate by 2020, 28%. We're now at 32% at this point in time. So that's good, but we had our meeting with our board, and they said, you got to lift the game. Because as good as these things are that we're talking about, it's just simply not at the scale that we need to happen. So what does it need to lift ambition? One piece is I think we need to go from nice projects and good examples to systemic change that actually allows investments to step up at scale. And so we're trying to think very much about this within the World Bank Group in terms of how every project that we get involved in is not only for the benefit of that project, but how does it create a new industry? Like we did in Noor on CSP. We didn't do that project and put that amount of financing in it just to have the impact in one project. It's got to have the spillover effect. How do we create battery markets? How do we create decentralized energy markets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? We've got to go from the individual project to scale. Having said that, we think it's very important over the next 3 to 5 years to actually show progress on the ground. Okay, much of the stuff that Josh presented is pretty well known now. Okay, the storyline, I think, is pretty well accepted. The question is putting it into practice. And so finding cases where we can blend this financing in an effective way, in ways that create new markets, that crowd in the private sector, the direct public finance, to bring the policy, we've got to prove it on the ground. And there, frankly, I think we have to work with proven mechanisms that we have. And that will come to it later. That's why I think mechanisms like the CTF are absolutely critical. What would that systemic response look like? The way we think about it is in three blocks. What do you need? You have to build the demand side. And that means taking the NDCs, and everybody talks about translating the NDCs into investments. Yes. But into policies is probably more important. And when people talk about lack of bankable projects, okay, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have an engineering blueprint for some nice investment that you want to make. It's that it's not a bankable project, which means you don't have the risk mitigation mechanisms around it to allow you to take it to the bank. So building on that demand side is absolutely critical. On the other extreme, you need to look at the supply of financing. This financing comes from government financing and from private sector and from MDBs. There are reforms that can take place in each one of those areas that can systematically help the direction of that financing. MDBs, we need to be focusing much more on creating markets and the aggregate leverage, not co-financing ratios per project, I agree with you, but how do we create this leveraging? Governments, there's a huge amount of public expenditure that's going in. How much of this is truly screened to be low carbon? How many ministers of finance are really looking at this expenditure and only allocating it if it is driving us in this direction? It's got to happen systematically. And then the private banks, all of the stuff that's moving on disclosure, on simplification of a number of things, all of that's important. And then in the middle, on intermediation, we've got to do a better job on systematically dealing with intermediation. What I mean by that? First of all, risk mitigation mechanisms, tiered financing, first loss provisions, guarantees. All of these mechanisms could be used much more systematically. And then there are issues of what we would call standardization and aggregation. Basically, an aggregation, if you just simply have individual deals that are being put together, all of those $1 trillion from the private sector is never going to go in there unless you can find a way of aggregating that up and standardizing the product, because they're not going to get involved for a $20 million investment where they have a project here that looks like this and a project here that looks like that. So to crowd this in, focusing on that intermediation piece is the third most important piece.
Thank you, John. We'll come to the role of the MDBs in the next round. I just wanted to stay with this context and see, you know, if Mathieu, from the regional development bank perspective, and from Latin America as a case example right now, how do you see the challenge, you know, in the region? I mean, it's the region actually which has perhaps done the best in terms of renewables because of its natural endowments, but in some senses being very challenged right now, partly because of the impact of climate change. So how do you see the investment agenda in the region, and what do you see is the contribution that, you know, that needs to be made?
Thanks, and thanks for having us today. Look, the infrastructure agenda is in a way is pretty straightforward. There's a $300 trillion funding gap for sustainable infrastructure in Latin America, and that's twice of what's been financing right now. So the volumes and the lack of financing are pretty significant. On the other hand, it's fair to say that if you look at a region like Latin America and the Caribbean, and you talk with investors, you do see a shift from those investors where, for them, investing in low carbon or investing in climate resilient infrastructure is a sound business case. So it's no longer something that is good to do because you look good. It's something that makes sense for them. So for insurance company, having its long-term assets that are climate resilient is something extremely important for us, for them, sorry. Conversely, the risk of having their assets that are insured and that become stranded is also a big issue for them. So you do have demand on the investor side to get into those investments. So the question is really why aren't they doing it? And I think it really ties to what we were discussing previously. The role for institutions like ours, you know, it's not so much to try to maximize co-financing in a given transaction, but really looking at addressing the market failures that are preventing those investors from getting into those projects. From what we see, there's probably three big items that we see in that space. The first one is mispriced externality. Interestingly, not so much on climate mitigation, because I guess right now you can make the case that this is a sound business proposition from a pure financial standpoint, but this is something you see very much in the case of adaptation. I would argue that in most cases for climate adaptation, it makes sense from an economical standpoint to invest into climate adaptation, but we haven't internalized yet this economical added value. The second one is information failure, and you know, the textbook example for that is energy efficiency. I mean, everybody knows that energy efficiency makes sense. There's very short payback period. Nonetheless, we've been lagging behind in terms of investment for energy efficiency. And last but not least, what I would personally call the first mover disadvantage is that there's a market inertia, especially when you try to go to institutional investors. You got to do it. You know, there needs to be someone that do it first in order for the other to come in. And this is especially true if you get into complex structure. This is especially true if you want to tap capital markets. This is an extremely conservative asset base, investor base. And there's really a lot of added value in trying to pilot those new structures and support those new structures so that eventually somebody will pick it up and it's going to be financed on its own.
So maybe, Kruskaya, I could ask you to build a little bit on that. I mean, one of the issues, so what are the failures? So one failure is basically the lack of familiarity, okay? Another is unproven technologies, because in this area, more as George said. A third aspect is really the cost of capital, the underlying cost of capital in emerging markets is high, often for macroeconomic reasons, not micro reasons. And that, of course, then is an endogenous proposition in the sense it makes the investment less viable. Okay. And the final aspect is that a lot of what we are trying to produce is a public good, and you have to think about affordability of that good for the person who is going to consume it. So when you combine these, there is a case for blending, but with different considerations. And you have been thinking about blending principles. So from that perspective, how do you see that in the context of this specific challenge, which is blending climate finance?
Thank you very much, and thank you again for the invitation. I think, you know, I'll pick up exactly with your leaving me, which is on the affordability, and walk my way through that. On the affordability case, I mean, what it is clear is that the blended finance needs to be used to try and, you know, bring it to the ultimate consumer at an affordable price. For that, you know, we could support a lower interest rate loan, but most of the time that's not the right instrument. So in some of these cases, the best approach that we have had to affordability is when we can start very early on at the, you know, upstream work. So as World Bank Group, we have, you know, the Scaling Solar, you know, initiative. And that is when, you know, from the time that the government is thinking about auctioning, you know, a concession, we are integrating, you know, the offering that we can have. So that if we have a piece of concessionality that we can offer, we can make it visible to the participants in the market. Then those participants can internalize that blended finance and bid in a tariff that is affordable. So, you know, it really depends on what you want to tackle, the instrument that you are going to use. You mentioned the lack of familiarity. The lack of familiarity links to what Matthew was saying. You know, there is some of it is the first mover disadvantage, because they are taking a lot of, you know, the heaviness of the process, the unproven policies, perhaps the technology that has not been scaled up. And for that, a reduction in the interest rate so that their cost of funding becomes affordable. So along with a reduced, you know, interest, makes sense. You are trying to really help them, you know, incentivize them to go there. Then when you think about technology and new business models, you may need a low interest rate. You may need to also play in the upstream. But the reality is there you need risk mitigation. And risk mitigation can come in two forms, effectively. One, which is your risk-sharing facility, in which, you know, usually if there is a market that has a lot of liquidity, you can simply stay behind as an MDB and say, I'm going to provide you risk mitigation in the form of a guarantee if something bad happens. On the other hand, there are other markets where liquidity is a big issue, and then a subordinated loan. So you are bringing the funding, you are crowding in the senior lenders to come in, and at the same time you are saying, if there are events, I'm going to be here to basically delay my repayments. So the climate investment funds has allowed us to do both. You know, although a lot of the portfolio, as it was mentioned, is on senior loans with lower interest rate, we have a number of transactions that have been the subordinated loans. And if you target the subordination to actually the market failure, it's a very powerful loan, because it's a very powerful instrument, because the other aspect that I don't think Joshua mentioned is that in some cases, then you get to protect the capital of the public sector. So this, the CTF has been, you know, very successful in being able to protect, you know, the principal, which means that then you can reuse it again. And that is the ability, and I think you mentioned leverage differential between the Global Environment Facility and the CTF. And what you will see there is the Global Environment Facility has mostly used grant instruments, which means that once the money is put out, you know, it's used. On the climate investment funds, a lot of what has been done is concessional finance, which means that there is the possibility of that money to come back and have the opportunity to, you know, to put it back. I think with bilateral funds, you see that trend now going on to what is called the concept of returnable capital.
So, if I could go back to you, and I'll come to John, I want to, on correcting this, some of these elements. But, you know, the Inter-American Development Bank as a group came out with this idea of NDC Invest, which tries to bring together many of these elements in terms of programming, in terms of the technology or the uncertainty side, and building the pipeline out and the policy, but then on the financing. How much, what would you say are the lessons from that, because I wanted that as a complement to some of the discussions we've had.
Thanks, Amaris. That's a very good question. You know, for us, NDC, the value of NDC Invest is it's a platform, and it's a platform that is recognizing that you can't address a given issue by just providing financing or just by looking at improving the regulation or just by looking at providing studies for a bankability of the project. If you want to be successful and if you want to be efficient in using a scarce public resources, you need to think about that as a whole. And that's really the key lesson learned and one that we've tried to apply with one of our recent bilateral fund with the United Kingdom that is targeting sustainable infrastructure, where we sort of tried to put a strong emphasis from the get-go in structuring this fund about having this sort of global approach to addressing those market failures. So this is not only a blended finance facility. This is not only a public sector technical assistance facility. This is not only a technical assistance facility for a project. We can do three of those, and the idea is that by doing that, we create a catalytic effect that is much more powerful than by looking at those different things separately.
John, I want to open the discussion to the floor and have some interaction. But before I do that, I wanted to come back to you and take up the last part of the discussion, which is, as you said, you know, a lot of the generalities are now known. The question is, how does one get traction at the country level? And in that, particularly, you know, what is the role that the, you know, multilateral climate funds can play in enabling the larger beast, which is the MDBs, mobilize the private sector? Because that, you can think of that as leverage on leverage. So, you know, the instrument for getting the private sector in are your institutions. But your institutions are constrained in dealing with some of the market failure. And one of the things that is not well recognized is that actually providing risk guarantees eats up a lot of capital. Okay, so, you know, if the MDBs are going to do more, and particularly in the areas that we talked about, which is unproven financing structures, unproven technologies, you know, and first loss guarantee type of stuff, either with liquidity, etc., then in some sense, you know, the model that has been built up is actually a powerful one. How do you see, therefore, the future, you know, in this area, and what are the gaps that have to be addressed?
Okay, thanks. So what I'd like to do is to start with by saying that the multilateral climate finance architecture right now is very complicated with a large number of funds that are trying to do different things. And I think part of the difficulty comes from the fact that there are multiple objectives from different stakeholders. It's all very well to have one objective that says there's a climate justice and countries need direct access for small amounts of money in order to lubricate the wheels, 10 million here, 50 million here, to implement an adaptation project there as part of the overall financing. That's fine, but I think we need to keep that very distinct from how we're going to use the climate finance architecture to transform structures of economies, to create markets, to mobilize the MDBs. As MDBs, okay, we should not be in the business of financing a small project here, a small project there, a small. We should not be using climate finance for that. That's a separate business niche. It's a completely different business model. What we can bring is we can bring scale, we can bring experience, we can bring presence on the ground, we can bring an ability to deliver high-quality products across public and private sector, we can move the dialogue, and at least on the World Bank side, we're a little bit better capitalized than we were a little while ago. So we have some capital that we can put. We can put $50 billion a year on the IDA and IBRD side and significant amounts of money on the IFC and MIGA side. The challenge is to find an efficient and effective way of using international concessional climate finance to leverage what we're doing. And so part of that, so there's an effectiveness piece, and I think it's important to be able to establish across the community what should you use that concessional finance for. And so we've said, okay, anything you're going to use, number one, it has to be aligned with the Paris objectives. Something that's interim and nice but won't get you there in the long run, we should not be using it for it, okay? Secondly, we should focus on the most difficult problems. And third, we should focus truly on transformation. And that means we should not just be allocating money based on an individual project here or there, but on what that contribution is to breaking open the market and doing something much more systematically. So that's on the effectiveness side. On the efficiency side, we've got to have a system where you have a significant amount of money that's available in predictable volumes with a clear business model that aligns with what the MDBs can do to build off the comparative advantage of the MDBs and is low transaction cost and doesn't include various forms of second guessing and extraneous things that are put on the top. And this is why I think the Clean Technology Fund has been very successful. It's a proven technology. Now, is it possible to create another fund, to build up another fund like the Green Climate Fund so that it could do this? Yes, maybe. Maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, you're going to get to a situation where you can create another fund. But why would we do that when we have an existing vehicle that can do this right now? So finding ways of, I think we've really got to stop trying to make the sort of the perfect the enemy of the good. Where we've got mechanisms that work, let's scale them up, put the resource in it, and keep it moving.
So I want to stress a couple of points that you mentioned and then get others to come in. I think, as you said, the key is systemic transformation. And the second is the primary comparative advantage for that in the international architecture rests with the multilateral development institutions because they operate all the way from the planning to the policy to the finance, and they can bring about change, and it's not about one project at a time. But what you need as a counterpart also is systemically significant concessional finance, so you are able to do things much more programmatically. That's what I heard you say. And I think, and the, you know, my personal view again is the climate investment funds and the CTF in particular established that track record in a very effective way, because it was that very close partnership with the multilateral development banks that was the key to its success. Now, given that backdrop, I mean, how, you know, from your side, do you see, I mean, I turn to you now, Kruskaya, from the IFC side, how do you see the future? I mean, what do you see, therefore, is what's needed? And the same question to you, Mathieu.
Thank you. I'll get started with this, just reiterating that it's the certainty and the availability of funds that is key for the private sector. Because although I am fully in agreement with John that we need to have the overall transformation, the private sector, at least the private sector that is creating the projects, see it as a project-by-project intervention. And it is the MDBs that can do the translation and say, this project really can have the demonstration that makes it transformational. And then also we can do the translation with the sources of finance that are pure private sector, with the institutional capital, where we say we are going to package these, you know, these transactions for you and let you invest, you know, on a large platform, and which is basically what IFC has been doing in infrastructure through our managed co-lending, you know, portfolio platform. And I think it is that translation that puts us in a very unique opportunity to do that. We cannot do that translation if we don't have the sources of finance available for, you know, concessional finance. As, you know, others have said here, it is important to understand that, you know, there is already a lot of sources there. And at IFC, we have been able to prove that that complementarity of sources can work very well. We have been, you know, users of the funds that we have had through the climate investment funds. About 50% of what we have done, you know, since FY10 comes with the sources of the climate investment funds. Then we know that we have been able to use very effective the bilateral funds that we have with Canada and more recently with Finland, and that we can use that as well. We are also an accredited entity of the Green Climate Fund and hope, you know, to be able to put strong partnerships there as well as we start moving this. And I think the important thing is how do we leverage what is already there so that we can keep moving effectively to more scale up. I mean, neither on the instrument side nor on the, you know, funding, we should be trying to reinvent the wheel.
So, Mathieu, I mean, you at the IDB, of course, have had a similar partnership now with UK Base, which has a lot of positives. But I, you know, I mean, I'm a humble academic. I can say things that you guys can't. Is it makes sense to have a lot of fragmented funds, or should we be multilateralizing some of this a little bit? And why, as John said, why not invest in something that's been working and use that? Because in some sense, it's a repeater game in partnership with other players. But why not get a little bit more coherence and scale in the architecture?
Oh, it's a good point, Luke, and let me give you some figures from the transactional perspective. We IDB Invest, we invest approximately 800 million of concessional resources. Now, those resources come from six donors, whether they're multilateral or bilateral, but they're divided into 17 pots of money, and each pot of money is going to have its own mandate, maybe its own country restriction, maybe its own focus. And really the difficulty for teams like ours is how do you balance the prospecting of the donor, which is going to be very supply-driven, from the perspective of our client, because we work with the private sector, that are demand-driven. And what's the right balance? And this is something we've been able to do more and more with the CTF, and the flexibility we've had in the CTF into going into things that are a little bit more exotic, for example, in terms of financial structuring, and allowing us also to experiment is something that is extremely important. It's very difficult to scale or to replicate something that you haven't tested before. And you do realize that much of the testing is actually opportunistic. It's a client that calls you, that is a friend with another of your client, and tells you, hey, I have this great idea, I have this great technology. for energy efficient street lighting, and I have a model that I believe is bankable even to work with municipalities, which is something we've done with the Canadian Fund and the CTF in Mexico, where we built an entire financing structure that was brand new, where we felt that that financing structure helped us to avoid the municipal risk that was otherwise preventing this project to move forward. So in that sense, fragmentation is obviously not that great, but at the same time, it's fair to say that, you know, what we've had with some of our bilateral donors is a little bit more flexibility and less second guessing on what we do. And to be fair, I would not necessarily include the CTF in that criticism. Now, the other thing that is worth mentioning, if you think about MDBs, I mean, MDBs are not perfect, far from it, but when you deal with concessional finance, I think you ought to realize that this is a great instrument, it's extremely catalytic, but it has risks. I mean, you're in the business, for lack of a better word, of distorting markets, which, you know, is not necessarily something that you want to do. You're also in a situation where you have to deal with conflict of interest. You know, you could be using those resources to get transactions from other MDBs because you're just offering a cheap loan. And in that sense, relying on the MDB infrastructure is something that is quite powerful. Those are institutions that are solid, that have processes, that have good governance, and that probably allow you to maximize the use of those concessional resources also by mitigating the underlying risks.
Which is why we need these principles.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think the G20 Hamburg principles were important, and the blended finance principles are very, very important. I will turn to the floor, but before I do that, Josh, I was going to ask you if you wanted to react to anything that's been said so far.
Sure. Just a couple of points, you know, underscoring a lot of what's already been said today. One is that, you know, I don't think we can understate, you know, the importance of existing processes for being effective. And this gets sort of essentially to the CIFs and the CTF, I think, in particular in this space, where if you look at the evolution, I think, of the CIF since 2008 and its capacity to deliver finance and work with the MDBs in an increasingly seamless way, you know, that's basically in key metrics of its effectiveness. So in a sense, when we talk about climate architecture and what do we do and what do we don't, I think, John, your point is start with what we've got. These constant, perfect being the enemy of the good, I think, is a real issue here. And in many respects, because we're working in reality with short timelines, I mean, it's really important to underscore that we have these goals out to 2050 and it sort of seems like it goes on forever. But at the end of the day, you know, Ma made this point in the introduction. I think we make this point in the paper. You know, the infrastructure timeline for getting it right is really less than 15 years. You know, and to some extent, you build out the wrong infrastructure. Now you're locking in a whole system which is going to basically deliver outcomes which are going to be inconsistent with all these agendas. The second point is, I think, on the private sector side a little bit. The other bit is that where the needs are particularly significant from both, from really the climate perspective in particular, which is where the CTF is sort of focused, which is this group of middle-income countries, essentially. And that is where also domestic private capital markets are going to be key. I mean, in many respects, I think there's sometimes this notional idea that it's constantly funding coming from sort of, you know, institutional investors or other private sector sources from the developed world, but it's really domestic capital, whether it's domestic sort of institutional investors that have developed up or just domestic banks and the like, which, you know, have to be mobilised. And in that respect, building up the domestic capital markets is really a key component of this. And to some extent, this is where, you know, some of the CTF investments in building out domestic capacity in the banking system, I think, can deliver really long-term gains in terms of making that available. And I think it also underscores the other point which has come through, which is this distinction between projects and building out sort of enabling environments which can be catalytic are blurred in the respect. I mean, you clearly need both. You need projects which are going to be project-specific but also can create markets, and you need these underlying broader-based structures at the same time. And in that respect, we haven't spoken about all that much the key policies which sort of work against these outcomes, which are clearly the absence of carbon pricing and fossil fuel subsidies. So we're constantly working against these lack of sort of key policy drivers which would channel investment in the right direction.
Okay, I'm going to open the floor to questions. And if you could identify yourselves, and please keep your intervention quite brief, because we would like to have an interactive discussion. One of the things I would really, really press for is gender balance. So thank you.
Like here, huh?
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
Thanks. My name is Luigi. I work for a private bank here in Washington, D.C., and my aim, unfortunately, is to bring our clients to the multilaterals seeking for risk mitigants and risk sharing. I say unfortunately because I think Confucius once said that those who move the mountains start by moving little rocks. So I appreciate what John said that, you know, the multilaterals have to have the big picture, that the private sector should leverage on the capacity of the World Bank Group, you know, to have, you know, the big picture, to have a broad picture of what's going on over the world. But the thing is that if you really want to make a systemic change, you have to start from approving and enhancing small projects. You know, you have microgrids in Africa. You know, there's no way you can build an overall grid network all over the continent. So you have to start from little things. So, I want to share my frustration, because every time I approach MIGA, for example, for a mitigant, they say, oh, no, no, this country has a too low rating. You know, we don't invest and we don't protect below double B minus. So what is MIGA doing, you know? When I approach the IFC, I have the feeling that I'm talking to, you know, JP Morgan bankers who are there to try to make more money than I am trying to make, rather than, you know, a multilateral trying to enhance investments where it is mostly needed. So I think, you know, if we want to be intellectually honest here, we have to admit that there is a wide gray area that we should really consider addressing. There is a big picture, and there are small projects, and we need to enhance the small projects, and we need to cover this gray area, I think. Thank you.
I think it is fair to say that a lot of the, particularly the space we are talking about, we are moving more and more into distributed projects, and that is, so John's point was about aggregation. I'll come back to that, but how do you deal with your specific concern? The lady, you had a question?
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you, Cinnamon Dornsife, Johns Hopkins SAIS International Development. And this may be a question for you, Josh, but anyone else could answer it as well. I'm wondering, where do you see these actual investments that you're leveraging and crowding in? Where have you seen the greatest growth? And I remember that you said that the CTF is very effective, and we should scale that up because it's an existing vehicle that works. Where do you see the greatest promise and why?
On this side, I'd seen some. Yes, there's a gentleman right here.
Thank you for the paper and the excellent presentations by the panel. When we do blended finance, how do we know we've got the right mix? Are there objective standards? I raise that because in the United States, where we have blended finance programs, we require an affordability assessment. And rating agencies look at affordability assessments and looking at risk. So I guess in the MDB principles, is there an assessment of risk? Is there a requirement for risk assessments in your assessment of evaluation of your blended programs?
There's a hand, my friend right in the back, right there.
Thank you. My name is Irving Mintzer. I teach in the Energy Resources and Environment Program at Johns Hopkins SAIS. Josh, your paper points out that the investment gap on infrastructure from 2015 to 2030 is on the order of $50 plus trillion. Which dramatically outstrips both the available capital in the multilateral development banks and probably what's going to be available from public capital sources altogether in this period. The only actors who have access to that volume of capital are institutional investors. But for the most part, they can't put money into the early stage investment in infrastructure projects that are whose risks exceeds their risk tolerance. So how do you see the multilateral development banks and the climate funds actually encouraging others in the financial services ecosystem to make those early stage investments that can later be refinanced by the institutional investors once the assets are used and useful and they have a reliable revenue stream?
Yeah, so I think we have a bunch of questions. I will just go, I think the one on the blended finance principles, and also I would say not only risk but the potential distortionary effects, I think both of you could cover. John, I thought you can take the question that were asked in the first two, and Professor Miss's question, I think Josh and I can also pick up on. But why don't we just go maybe from left to right and go ahead, Matthew.
So from right to left then.
Right.
Well, it depends which way you're looking. It's all a matter of perspective.
My left to right. Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe allow me just to react on the last question, because I actually used to work in investment banking, and I was structuring and selling project bonds in Latin America. So, to some extent, I can relate to what you were saying. And look, there's no easy answer. I think for us MDBs, it's first of all, and this is happening, but it's a cultural shift from a buy and hold sort of institution to an institution that is here to intermediate, to cover those initial risks and eventually distribute those assets once they become interesting for private capital. And in that sense, we do begin to see that in our region. So in Uruguay, for example, most of the projects that we initially financed, most of the renewable projects, wind and solar, that we initially financed under a balance sheet, now have started to operate it, and three of those were refinanced through an AB bond structure that was sold to institutional investors. And actually one of those bonds, because it was the first solar bond we believe in the region, was also benefiting from some support from blended finance. So, to some extent, it's really a call for sophistications for MDBs and really being able to, and each project, its asset is going to be different, but being able to think about, you know, when you invest in a particular project, not so much, okay, I'm going to hold that project for the entire life of the project, but rather what sort of structure, what sort of incentive structure am I building from the structuring phase of the project, so that eventually this gets refinanced by an institutional investor. And you know, there's a couple of examples. You could be having some provisions in your loan to that that developer of a solar plant that, you know, once he's operating, unless he's refinancing with somebody else, you're going to charge him 50 basis points more. This is something that we start to see and we start to do, and that's very, very effective if there's an attractive market to refinance. I think on the principle, and to some extent, I don't want to talk too much about the principles because Kruskaya is leading the MDB working group on that. Other than saying that when you look about the ecosystem of blended finance, what you do see today is still a lot of fragmentation in what people do and how people sort of use concessional finance. Um, and And in that sense, the work that MDBs have been doing in terms of creating a framework of principles and also be a little bit more concrete, so from those principles extracting guidelines, going into concrete cases and providing guidance not only amongst MDBs but also to the market in general is something very important. And maybe just ending on one specific point, looking at the long-term commercial sustainability of a project when you do blended finance is paramount. So we're not in the business of permanent subsidy. If we don't think the project that we're financing is not commercially viable in the long run, this is not a value proposition for blended finance, full stop.
John?
Okay, good. So I think your question on small projects and how a small project developer and a financier can get support in audits is a very good question. I think the dilemma is from the point of view of an MDB, for us to get involved in a $5, $10, $15 million investment, even if it's in a small country and it makes a lot of, it's a very high transaction cost, very expensive. The same applies to an institutional investor that's going to come behind it, and in fact, even a national bank. Okay, they've got to understand your business, your technology, all of this kind of, all the information barriers of this. It's very difficult to move forward. And the question is, if we do it, is this going to get scaled up? Where is it going to go much further? So that is why I think we need to be focusing on mechanisms and institutions that aggregate and simplify such projects and give them access in a more scalable way. So, for example, in India, there are a number of different schemes that are underway to try and facilitate rooftop solars or distributed solar. So, for example, the one that I'll just talk about, there's other models. Okay, we're working with State Bank of India to increase their capability to invest in rooftop solar facilities with individual people. So by doing that, by giving them some backstopping lines of credit and stuff, they can do their lending. They can go down the learning curve because now they've got predictable finance behind it. They can go down the learning curve so they understand what this business is. They can work with their clients to develop a portfolio. So what you end up at the end is the individual investments get the financing that they need, but you've already embedded the knowledge and you're already bringing it to scale. And these are the models that you can debate exactly how and what you do, but these are the directional models I think we need to move on. Just a question, just come to this last one on what I call this takeout financing. I think there's a huge opportunity out there because you saw it from the risk curve. Okay, there is no reason, honestly, why we as an MDB need to continue providing finance once a transmission line is up and running, once a hydropower dam is up and running. Our comparative advantage is in structuring the deal at the beginning because it's not only the fact that we can take the risk, it's that we can manage the risk. Okay, we're a financier, we don't have direct liability for the management, but we can influence the procurement arrangements, the financial structuring, the contractual viability, the social, the land act, all of that stuff we can do. Now, the trick is, this is not a new concept. Okay, we've talked about this for a million years. The issue is how do we put it into practice? Right now on the bank side, we're in discussions in a number of countries in some of these areas, particularly around transmission, to simply try and sell off the existing loan. Forget about new projects. Let's just take our existing transmission debt and sell it into the private sector. Sell it into the institution. Institutional investors have an appetite for this debt. When we talk to institutional investors, they say that's the profile that they love. Now, one of the difficulties is that right now, our lending rates are lower than where these are going to come in. So the question is, how do you broker that deal? Either can you find for the first two or three deals some concessional finance that will lubricate it? Can you get an agreement between how much of that differential that you're going to have to fill in the financing will come from the government, how much will come from the power transmission company, who will share in this so that you can scale it up to the next level? I think once we can do a few deals like that, then I think we can get into the situation where, as you said, we should be structuring our financing of hydro deals or things like this in ways that it's clear that we're going to try and get out. You design it at the beginning so we can get out, people can come in, all these issues. I think this is absolutely critical. We're trying to mimic this a little bit, for example, in the solar park that we're doing in India, where essentially what we're doing is we help with the structuring of the bidding documents, okay, but we also finance the basic land infrastructure. Think of it as sort of an infrastructure zone for solar power. So we finance the base infrastructure. We ensure that the transmission line comes in, because that's where the risk is, on the land acquisition and the timeline. And so when the bid is bid, they're only bidding to put solar panels on the existing infrastructure with an existing evacuation line, with an existing offtake guarantee. And so they're financing. It's part of the same concept. I think it's a question of how do we put – it's project management 101. How do you put the risks with the people that can manage? Institutional investors cannot manage these risks. And so we've got to really go back to basics on some of these.
Thank you, John. Chris Garrett, so if you could answer the questions around, you know, what principles are there so that MDBs are market creating, and at the same time, using in some sense blended finance also most efficiently and effectively.
Thank you. Before I get that, if I can just comment very briefly on, what John was mentioning about the takeout. And yes, it has been something that we have been trying to do forever. I think the other thing is trying to see if there are models in which we can do it up front. And, some of our co-lending, platforms at this moment in time, what it's trying to do is to convince those institutional investors, in this case, insurance companies, that the track record that we have for 60, years in developing markets is something that they can take, that we know how to do this. Exactly what John was saying, because, our comparative advantage is to understand the assets. So if we can convince them up front based on our past record, what we are trying to see is if we can bring them, alongside, even if there needs to be a little cushion of a guarantee with a government or something, because that will basically will say, okay, if IFC was wrong and we have less returns than we expected, or our risk is higher than we expected, someone will come and cover us. But that way you are bringing those institutional investors up front. So that's one model. And then a small point with respect to how small you can go. I mean, there are opportunities to go small, but I think the issue there is that you are not being as impactful as you can be. As Matthew mentioned, there will be some demonstration transactions, and thanks to the PPCR, in the climate investment funds, we have been able to do that. Why? Because we are looking at climate adaptation. And in some of them, if you don't pilot very small, you won't be able to do it. So there we have even done a risk capital equity investment on $250,000 in a hydro project. What did we use that money for? To try to see how the study upfront of that design could be climate resilient. Today, hydro plants are not being, put together on a climate resilient manner. That small amount helped us to do the feasibility study. We are thinking now about the financing, phase. There will be a need for blended finance as well. PPCR will come in, and then the other funds that we have, which again talks about the complementarity of creating some pipeline upfront with these small amounts of public funds so that you can come later on. Then I get to the point of the principles and how do we think about this in the blended finance group. I run you very quickly through the five principles so that you can get a sense. This is publicly available in our website, so if you go IFC Blended Finance, where you will find it this. But basically the first idea is, what is the market failure, the economic rationale for blending? If the market can do it, if IFC or the other MDBs can do it on our own, we shouldn't be touching it with blended finance. And when we are talking in this context about blended finance, is blended concessional finance. That finance that is not taking full price for that risk, and therefore there is an embedded subsidy, and we are very frank about that. The second, the second principle that we utilize is this idea of minimum concessionality and crowding in. When public finance is done, concessional public finance, then, there is usually specific instruments. There is a long-tenure loan that is more concessional, a shorter-tenure loan that is less concessional. The beauty of the blended finance in private sector operations is to be able to tailor that. There are some trade-offs on that it can make it more complicated, but what we are trying is to minimize the level of concessionality. If you know, in a country that is a middle-income country, that the technology is already, you know, proven, you just need a small amount of blending. That is what you should give, not more than is needed. So that's the second the one, and it's linked to this idea of crowding in the private sector. The third one is the commercial sustainability that, you know, Matthew was talking about. We really look at each project or each, you know, a group of projects that we are trying to finance and say, in 5 to 7 years, can the private sector come in a more, you know, a commercial solution so that we don't need to have public finance over and over and over. And then the fourth principle tends to do a lot of what we do as a public and private, you know, group of MDBs, because it's about reinforcing markets. So with our, you know, some of you might be familiar with the AIDA fund, you know, the fund that the World Bank Group has for the poorest countries. Last year we received an allocation of $2.5 billion there for IFC and MIGA to have a private sector window. And what we are trying to do there is to ensure that, you know, we are reinforcing what the World Bank is already doing at the policy level. You know, there are many already interventions in lending that is being done to the national development banks. We should be seeing this as a continuum that is bringing the private sector along. So that's the reinforcing market. And the last point has to do about governance and about high standards and principles. What we can bring as MDBs is that ability of saying we are going to use public funds in a way that is in the same level of standard that our funds are used. So if environmental and social, you know, elements of a project are not good enough for our finance, they shouldn't be good enough for the blended finance money to come in. Governance is as important. We are trying to make mainstream gender considerations. So all those elements are part of it. In the case of IFC, we have a separate governance that ensures that every project goes to a separate independent committee within IFC to look at how these principles are being met. Other MDBs have different forms of, you know, working with those principles. Some of them have much more a codified principles, you know, document where they will check with their economies how to do that. So there is a range of, you know, ways to get these principles mainstream in what we do. But if our blended finance, to give you an example, from IFC in the early 2000s, we had 40 million for blending. Right now, when you look across all the sectors and including the private sector window, we have about 3.5 billion for blending. So it's, you know, the amount of funding is there and it needs to be done in a professional way. And I think that is what we are trying to do with the MDBs. However, as MDBs, we can have really nice stories out there, wonderful principles, but it's really our donors, our stakeholders that need to hold us to that, you know, to those agreements. And we have ourselves been asking, you know, the new funders that are giving us the broad amounts of money to ensure that, you know, they require us to have those principles in each of those transactions, because otherwise, as Matthew said, the risk is that, you know, I will say, I love that project in Latin America, let me add a little bit of a concessional finance so that I can compete with IDB Invest, and that shouldn't be the purpose of it.
Great. I'll be quick. A bit of this has been answered. I guess, you know, when you think about the intersection between where's the most effective deployment, from one perspective, if we think purely about this from a climate perspective, and we have been focused, it's worth noting, on the mitigation side, and particularly because the CTF is mitigation focused, so this is not adaptation. You know, you might sort of make the argument, well, look, you know, reducing greenhouse gas emissions in any country is helpful because it's a global problem, but it doesn't address the other side, which is that you want to invest in countries also where you can be sort of transformative, and that requires scaling. So in many respects, you start looking at the larger, essentially emerging developing countries where, you know, both individual projects and also broader sort of policy reforms can actually have a major transformational impact. And in some respects, this cuts across also some of the politics that it gets associated with the climate finance discussion around access to the finance and how it gets distributed and the like. And there's a bigger issue here around, you know, the UN context for having climate financing and where the SIFs have been focused. And I think one of the, in terms of where we focus, I think one of the key, you know, things that we understand is that energy efficiency particularly has got a big chunk of what actually is possible. Yet, you know, there is an absence of that to some extent. It's the sort of equivalent of, you know, dollar bills lying around on the ground. And the reason that this is happening is because getting at it is actually very complicated. It's often small-scale investments. It requires particular sort of micro reforms. But in many respects, you know, this is a big bucket which can require concentrated focus and where a lot of potential is there. On the last question about scaling, we've heard a lot about it before. I think public finance needs to scale, nevertheless, more than is available, but certainly the private sector is going to be key to that. And one of the points sort of in the paper I wanted to make clear is that one of the things we need to think about this in terms of, you know, particularly the clean technology funds, but the multilateral climate funds in particular, is what can they do that the MDBs are unable to do in terms of addressing risks? And we see that the MDBs are moving rapidly to increase their capacity to invest in climate outcomes. The funding that is going to be available in these multilateral climate funds is always going to be tiny compared to needs. But the question is, how do we design those funds to be optimal? And in some respects, I think the CTF has shown a way forward here, where you've got concession finance that's even more concessional, that's flexible, that can be rapidly deployed, and that can be used most effectively in a blending environment with the other available public resources to push an outcome into a project that might not otherwise be viable. So in many respects, it's recognising sort of the scarcity but also the high concessionality of the climate funds as the sort of key inputs into the broader blending finance where we're going to see major impact.
Thank you all to my panellists. I just want to close by saying what we perhaps didn't address as clearly, because, you know, we use the word donors, but I would really use that there is a global governance issue, which is, you know, is this architecture fit for purpose? Will it give us what we need? And I think part of that is about ensuring that we are getting the most out of all sources of finance, and that this is very much about effectiveness. But in the end, it's also about adequacy of the overall architecture. And I think there is a question about whether we have right now the sums of finance in order to meet the challenge. Yes, we have to get all the upstream part right. Yes, we have to make sure that we are getting the most out of every dollar, but we also have to make sure that there are adequate dollars on the table. And in terms of these multilateral climate funds, there's perhaps too much fragmentation. But I think the point that John made, you know, if we have a good mechanism such as the CTF in place, why is it that we are not able to mobilize the financing from the international community? And that's something that all of us have to ask in some sense in order to ensure that the governments of the day are able to meet that challenge. So we didn't focus on that issue, but particularly here in this town, it's a very big issue. So thank you very much for coming, and thank my fellow panelists.